Hello, my name is Jennifer Marsman, and you have joined a webcast on the Windows 8 platform for Metro-style apps and the Windows Store. I am a developer evangelist for Microsoft, and I have all my contact information listed here. So if you do have questions that you come up with after the talk or things that you want to connect with me later, feel free to reach out however you're most comfortable. I do have a blog, and I'm on Twitter and all of that as well. All right, so let's dive right into it. With Windows 8, there is a new category of applications called Metro-style applications. Now, the applications that we're used to from the Windows 7 and before days still do exist in Windows 8. So you can continue to use the applications that you built in Windows 7. They will run on Windows 8. That is still continued to be true. But what we're calling those now is desktop apps, because those were built to work and run on the desktop. So those applications that you're familiar with now, if you write C# or VB code right now, or C++, whatever it is, you probably use a standard set of libraries then to interact with core operating system services. So you would use .NET to get functionality like writing out to the file system and things like that. .NET, Win32, whatever the case may be. So those applications still do continue to exist in Windows 8 and can be developed for Windows 8. But in addition to desktop applications that are built for and run on the desktop, we also have a new breed of applications called Metro-style applications. And Metro applications utilize a library called WinRT for the Windows runtime. And the WinRT APIs contain all of the same functionality that you would expect to need to interact with the operating system. And we will jump into some of those APIs in just a second. And then another key point that I really want to highlight here is the fact that with Metro-style applications, you do have a choice on what language and platform you want to use. So in terms of languages, there are actually three main options. One of them is not listed on the slide. The first is XAML. So if you are a .NET developer by trade, if you've done development in Silverlight or WPF or Windows Phone, or anything like that that already uses XAML and you're already comfortable with it, great. You can continue to use XAML with Windows 8 in conjunction with C#, VB, C++. It does work with C++ now, which is awesome. So you do have all of those capabilities right now to develop Metro-style applications for Windows 8. But if you come from a web development background and you're more comfortable with the webby side of it, then you can also use HTML. So that would be HTML5 in conjunction with CSS3 and JavaScript to develop Metro-style apps. And I'll be showing some examples of this later as well. And then finally, the third option, which is not shown here, is DirectX. So if you're doing very intensive gaming graphics, that sort of thing, you can use DirectX as an option as well. So this is kind of a high-level overview of this new Metro-style applications that utilize the WinRT APIs. And in case you haven't seen it yet, let me give you a quick demonstration of Windows 8. I'm going to jump over to my desktop here. And now hopefully you can see Visual Studio. I'm sorry, you can see my PowerPoint, all the stuff that I was doing before. And one thing you may notice about this, that Windows 8, it still has a desktop. I can still show you my desktop like so. You still see a normal desktop like you are used to with Windows. The main thing that is different with the screen is if you go to the lower left-hand corner, where you typically before saw that Windows icon and then that start menu, which was a static list of programs, that's not there anymore. Instead, we now have a new start menu, which you can access through several ways. If I go here and hover here with the mouse, you see there's a start menu that pops up. I can click there. If you're using touch, you can also swipe from the right-hand side of the screen and bring up the charms bar. And the middle charm is the Windows, the start menu charm, so you can touch that. Or using my keyboard, I can hit Windows D. I'm sorry, just Windows key. The Windows key then, any one of those three options will take you to the new Windows start menu. So all this replaces, all this new UI does, is replace that start menu that was in the lower right-hand corner. And it still gives me a list of all of my programs, but now instead of having my programs be just a static list of programs and here's what they do. You know, here's just a list of names of programs. I have tiles of my programs, and these can be live tiles, which are live with activity. So you can see I do have a mail icon right here. This is a mail program. And in my mail program, it's updating it with the last 5 emails I have received, which is always very exciting doing live demos, what things can pop up there. I also have a people hub. This orange tile is a people hub. And the people hub shows, I actually have it connected to my Facebook account. So you can see my last couple of Facebook updates, requests from various programs and posts on my wall and that kind of thing, all popping up in Facebook. I also have my calendar here. It's showing me the meeting that I'm in right now or what I'm supposed to be doing right now, which is good. Since I just wake up every day and obey my Outlook, here's what I'm doing right now, or I should be doing. And then all of these programs can be grouped together in various categories. So if you see in these categories, I do have various categories of apps. I have all my dev tools grouped together. I have all the office tools grouped together, various reading apps and utilities and things like that, games. So one thing that you may wonder is, okay, Jennifer, do you really have to swipe, or use the, you can also use the mouse to move. If you see, I have this scroll bar at the bottom as well to use using a mouse. And so you may wonder, is this the most efficient way to navigate? And so I can tell you there's actually a different way to do it as well. You can also use semantic zoom. So right now I just kind of zoomed out and I can see all of my categories, all of those groups of applications grouped together at a high level right here. And you can actually select one too by doing a quick little swipe down using touch and then see that name group. That will allow you to name the group. So looking at this from this high level, you can name, group your things together, and you can see the various groupings that I've used here and then be able to have those all grouped together. So that makes it very efficient. If I'm at the beginning of my list like so, here I am at the beginning of my start menu, I can zoom out if I wanted to get to games real quickly, swipe over and zoom in very quickly. And I am doing this using a touch machine, but this capability is also available in just a regular non-touch machine as well by using Control Plus and Control Minus for semantic zoom. So let me show you an example of a Metro application. So one such example is a game called Cut the Rope. And if I start up this game, I can hit play, and you can see a little, my doorbell has rung, a little nom nom has appeared, and so I can go in here, select the first level, and this is a very simple game. It uses a really good physics engine, and I'm going to slide across, and what I have to do is hit as many of those stars as possible to deliver candy to that little nom nom guy. You can see I got an obscene amount of points for doing almost nothing. Very good. The next level, you get a little harder. I can cut this guy, move this over there, boom, cut again, and boom, I got all the stars and delivered the candy. All right, so I was using touch. You can also use a mouse to swipe and do this as well. But you can see this is an example of a Metro style application. It runs full screen, immersive. There's no Chrome. So that's kind of the Metro style experience. So you saw the new start screen. You saw that this desktop still exists. It's absolutely the same, except that the start menu is now in a different place. The other thing is that there is this charms bar right here. The charms bar are these 5 little things, operating level functionality, operating system, ways to tie into the operating system using search, share, settings, etc. And we're going to talk a little bit more about these when we jump into the code. But for right now, let's jump back to the PowerPoint. All right, so that was a very quick demo of Windows 8. So we saw briefly a quick look at Metro style applications. So in at Build, which was the conference way back in September, where the development model for Windows 8 was introduced, a guy by the name of Jensen Harris did a two-hour long talk on Metro-style applications. And essentially, his entire talk was these eight qualities right here. And so I'm going to try to give you a condensed version of that and jump into some code to show you how you might go about doing these things to develop Metro-style applications. But these are the eight qualities of a Metro-style application. I do apologize. I know this drives me crazy that the definition is somewhat recursive. Metro-style apps have Metro-style design and embrace Metro principles. Kind of like when you look up the definition of esoterically in the dictionary, and the definition is in an esoteric manner, and you're like, that did not help me if you did not know the definition in the first place. But here we go. All right. So Metro-style apps. So the first is that they embrace Metro-style design. So there's a bunch of key qualities of Metro-style design. One of them that I'd like to focus on is content before Chrome. And so you saw in those Metro-style applications, in that cut the rope game that I showed you, that these Metro-style applications run full screen. It's all about the content, not the Chrome. It's not about the window that they sit in. And we actually did a series of focus groups with various people and asked them to draw, what does a Windows app look like? And what they drew was kind of the same thing from everyone, was a box. And in the upper right-hand corner of the box, there were three little boxes that were the minimize, maximize, close, the little X in the upper right-hand corner, and that everyone's familiar with. They may have drawn a file, edit, you know, those same menu bars that people are used to, a start menu along the bottom of the screen. They drew the Chrome, right? When people ask for a definition and draw what a Windows app looked like, they drew the Chrome. And really, what we've learned is that it's all about the apps. It's all about the content. That's what really should matter. So with Metro-style applications, the content runs full screen. It's a fully immersive experience where you get to immerse yourself in that application. And so the Chrome does go away. The next quality of a Metro-style app is fast and fluid. So fast and fluid is just an absolutely key point to Metro-style applications. If you went to Build at all and listened every time someone said the word fast and fluid, it was a lot. So with fast and fluid, what we mean by that is that these applications do have to be highly responsive. And so there is actually, if you want to submit to the Windows Store, there is a limit that your app does have to respond within 50, 60 milliseconds, okay? So you have to be fairly quick in how responsive your application is. And so the way to do that is by using asynchronous programming. And asynchronous programming may be unfamiliar to some of you, but it's a very, very simple pattern if you can get used to it. The main way to wire things up is to first set up an event handler against the event that will fire at the end of your asynchronous method, and then make an asynchronous call. And the convention to use is when you write a method that is asynchronous, have it end in async. And you'll find in the WinRT libraries a whole bunch of things that are already asynchronous that will allow you to do to write good asynchronous code. So you can write these asynchronous things, you make your asynchronous calls, they will go out and do something in the background, and then whenever that thing is done, an event should fire, and then you should have already wired up an event handler that would, you know, latch onto that event, and then that will continue your code executing. All right? So that will create a very fast, fluid experience, which is imperative, especially when we think about how Windows 8 is designed for touch first. And so what we mean by that is that it's not just touch enabled. So you can very easily use Windows 8 without touch as well. There's keyboard shortcuts for everything, and you can do all the same functionality with a mouse as you could with touch. But to design for touch first means that you are thinking proactively about things like, you know, if I put my finger down on the screen at this point, is it big enough for my, you know, the pad of my finger to be able to do that easily, or do I have to use a fingernail to poke at it and get the, to touch the right place? You need to easily be able, when you're touching something, that there's not underneath your hand a delete all button that you're accidentally going to swipe. Things like that you have to be thinking about with touch first. So fast and fluid is very important for touch, because if I touch something on the screen and I drag it across the screen and that is lagging, like the item that I'm trying to move is lagging a few seconds behind instead of staying right underneath my fingertip, that's a horrible, just absolutely unusable experience. So fast and fluid really is a key point. The next quality is snap and scale beautifully. So I am running currently on a 10 or 11 inch slate device that is touch enabled. But I want applications that I build to look good not only on this slate device, this small slate, but also on a 27 inch monitor. So you have to write your applications to make sure that they scale well to various form factors. And so one of the key things that enables this is in Visual Studio, there is now, in this new Visual Studio version for Windows 8, there is a simulator that allows you to show what your application looks like at various form factors. And then the other part of this is Snap, and we can show Snap too. So let me just go ahead and jump right into Visual Studio, and I'll show you Snap and then the ability to scale. So I'm going to jump back to my desktop. And here I am in Visual Studio, and I have an application open here called the Contoso Cookbook. I will show you a little bit more about that in a second. But first, let me show you in Visual Studio. Currently, I'm running, having it debugged to the local machine. I'm going to change that and now say that I want to debug to the simulator. So now I have the simulator here, and I'm going to click that to run this Contoso Cookbook application inside of the simulator. The simulator will fire up, and when that starts, what we're going to see is my application running in a Windows 8 box. And so I have the ability to be able to see that and to run it at various form factors. So let's take a look at that first, and then we can take a look at Snap. So as you can see, here is my Windows 8 desktop. The Contoso Cookbook application is launching. And then inside of that, we now see what my Contoso Cookbook looks like. And right now, I am running, there's a little square icon right here that says change resolution. So if I click that, you can see that right now I'm running at a 27 inch monitor size. And everything kind of lays out. You see various recipes here. There's Chinese recipes, French recipes, German recipes, and they all kind of flow downward in these little groups. I can also run this as on a kind of the same thing that a slate. This is what my 10.6, I guess I should say, inch slate. And you can see how it lays out a little bit differently now. It readjusts itself to look good on my slate, the way it's laid out. So now we see, instead of having just two kind of columns of Chinese food, it actually makes three columns wide of Chinese food to make it all fit well. And I can use touch to select one of these options. So I just touched this French dip sandwich. And you can see for each one of these recipes, it shows the title of the recipe, a picture of the recipe, and then prep time in the first column. In the second column is the ingredients, and in the third column is directions. And so this is what a typical layout looks like. But another feature in Windows 8 is something called Snap. And you see that when we have our applications running in this full screen immersive way, you only have one application on the screen at a time. However, with the way all of us multitask nowadays, there are times when you may want two applications on the screen at the same time. And that is what Snap supports. So Snap allows you to have one application snapped to either side of your screen. So I can show you this. The keyboard shortcut for Snap is Windows period. And so I can hit Snap, and you can see that my recipe now snapped to one side of the screen, and it can actually snap to the other side as well. Either side will work, and then we can go back full screen as well. So with Snap, you can see that something happened to the way my content was laid out. Before, in the first column, there was only that French dip sandwich, the title, the picture, and the prep time. But now in snapped mode, you can see if I only had those things, then I would have had a ton of white space at the bottom of the snapped view. So what we did is actually move the ingredients list underneath these things to have it lay out and have all of this content fill the space that we had available to us. And that was actually pretty easy to do in code using something called CSS media queries. So let me show you an example of that right now. But what happened, so make sure you understand the functionality. What happened is this ingredients that were before in that second column when we were like here, we saw the ingredients in the second column. And then once it was in snapped mode, we had all of these things plus the ingredients now in the first column. So let's take a look at that. I'm going to stop the code for a second. I will go ahead and close the simulator as well. Back to local machine to do the rest of the demos here. And now this is the CSS that I'm using. This is actually the item detail page CSS. This is what we were using to show the actual recipe content. And right here, if I scroll down a little bit, here's my ingredients where I lay out the ingredients. And you can see the ingredients were laid out as we saw in the second column, column two. Now let's see how we're able to relay this out in snapped mode. So this is an example of a media query. I am using a media query based on the screen, and then there are four different MS view states. So these, of course, are specific to Microsoft. CSS media queries are actually specific to CSS. They are in the CSS spec. So that is an industry-wide thing. These are Windows 8 specific states, such as the snapped state. That's something that's specific to Windows 8. So of course, these should live in a vendor specific role. So this MS view state gives the four different states that are available in Windows 8. So right now, snapped is one particular example. And so what happens is this is queuing in, and if it finds that we are now laying out this content in snapped mode, it will automatically re-render the content using this information right here. And you can see, let's go down to our ingredients. With our ingredients, now instead of being in column two, we've adjusted this to be in column one. So I've now moved from column two down to column one, but in a row two, so that this will lay out underneath that title, picture, and prep time that we already saw. And I'm actually doing the exact same thing here in full screen portrait mode, which is another thing we can show using the simulator. You can actually flip, you can emulate touch through that simulator. You can actually emulate a slate and be able to pick it up and turn it into portrait mode and show what that looks like as well, very easily. So the exact same thing would happen if we moved the slate into portrait mode. We would take those ingredients and put them into the first column in the second row, so it would lay out underneath. And then the same thing with the directions, which were on the third column before, will also move into the first column, into the third row, so that everything will flow top to bottom as opposed to left to right. All right, so a very simple example of how you can use media queries to relay out your page and take advantage of snapped mode. Let's jump back to the slides real quick. All right, so we saw how to snap and scale beautifully and use the Visual Studio Simulator to test some of that functionality. Next, let's talk about contracts. So there's a number of contracts in Windows 8, which are essentially operating system level functionality that you can tap into. So I showed you briefly that charms bar, and there were some things in the charms bar like search and share. And so you can actually take advantage of what we call contracts to hook into that operating system functionality, so that whatever is currently on your running on your screen is what you can search over and share over. So it is context specific to whatever is currently on your machine or currently on your screen. So let me go ahead and show you an example of that. I'm going to jump back into the code. And let me go ahead and run this now. I'm going to run it just using local machine first for now, since I've already shown you the simulator. And so we were talking about contracts. So you see, I can actually swipe in and bring up my charms bar. You can also do this using Windows C as the keyboard shortcut. And here's the search contract. Now, if I were searching, if I had the start menu up and I touched this search, it would by default search my applications, because that's what the start menu is, a list of applications. But what I've done is tied into this so that when my Contoso Cookbook application is active, I can hit search and it will actually search over my Contoso Cookbook. So I can go ahead and search for something that I may find in here. Let me use sugar as an example, because there's actually a lot of applications that use sugar. So I can type that in and hit enter. And now I see this nicely formatted HTML list of a whole bunch of different recipes that contain sugar. And for each result that was returned, I get a nice little picture, the recipe title, and the prep time. And And so you can also see that there were some nice filters that were appear here. So I can actually touch like just the Chinese recipes and get just those Chinese recipes coming back that were able. So you can apply nice filters over these recipes as well. All right, so very cool thing you can do there. The other thing I want to show you with search, just very briefly, is that you also have the ability to get Ajax-like functionality. So if there's things that are going to be very common search terms that you may want to make very easy for the user to find, you can create a list of search terms and make those pop up easily. So let's say oil is a very common thing that you use in cooking. I'm going to just type the O for oil, and you can see oil automatically pops up as a suggested term in my cookbook. So I'll show you how to go about doing all of these things right now. Let's go back to the code. All right. So here is search. To implement search, I'm going to give you kind of a quick look at what is there and then tell you that it's not. You don't actually have to write as much code as this may look like, but here's what we have to implement that search. First, we have CSS to lay out the search properly. We have a search.html, like so, to give you those nicely formatted search results that we saw. And then finally, we have some search JavaScript. I'm actually going to walk you through this because this is a little more information. All right, so here in search, let me go full screen so you can actually see everything well. And what we have here is, first of all, some namespace aliasing. So I have this app model nav, a couple of just namespace aliases like so. I have a pointer back to my corresponding HTML from this JavaScript. And then I have a number of methods. So let's take a look at these. The first is generate filters. So what I'm doing here is first clearing the list of filters. So we have an empty set here. And then I am pushing on here all of the search results by returning true. And then having that all filter at the top, which will return everything. And then here, I'm iterating through all of my groups. So those are those groups of recipes, like Chinese recipes, French recipes, German recipes, Indian recipes, etc. And for each of those, I am grabbing only the recipes that match that particular group. All right, so that will allow me to filter by those particular recipes. All right, and then the group name I'm using right there is the title of the group, such as Chinese, etc. All right, the next thing is item invoked. So this is what happens when you actually touch or click on one of those search results. And what that will do is navigate you to the corresponding recipe page, like so, passing in the correct data. There's also search data. What this does is actually the meat of the search. You can see that we're using regular expressions for our search, and I am matching on the title and the directions. I don't need to match on the ingredients because anything that's in the ingredients will also be in the directions, like sugar, etc. You're going to use in the directions as well. There's apply filter, which applies the filter as one would expect to create that filtered list. There's filter change, so this is what happens when the user selects a new filter. We're going to adjust the code to show that new filter. There's the handle query, so this is the kind of Uber function that calls everything else in here. So you can see here's this mark text. We're going to show that in a second. Update layout, generating the filters, searching the data, populating the filter bar, applying the filter, all of that stuff is done in here. Mark text, what this does is highlight. So if I searched for sugar, what I want to do is then when I get to the recipe that is selected, I want to highlight all instances of the term sugar in there. So highlighting my search term is done using mark text, also using regular expressions. We have this populate filter bar, which generates the filter list. And then we have a ready function right here. That's what happens once you the user navigates to the page, and that calls this Uber function of handle query. We have update the layout, which obviously re-renders the layout. This on activated and such. And then the other thing that's really important to show here is this on suggestions requested. So this is the thing that gave us that Ajax-like functionality where if I typed in the O for oil, it would automatically suggest oil to me. And so the way you do that is by specifying a number of search terms that you think may be very common terms for your application. And then I'm going to iterate through each of those and add those to a search suggestion collection by appending on a new query suggestion, and each one of those gets added into that collection. Okay? So this may seem like kind of a lot of code to you, but it actually isn't that bad, and I'll tell you why. The reason is we actually can get a lot of that code by doing by using a template, an item template in Visual Studio. So let me show you. I'll right click on Contoso Cookbook, and here I can do Add New Item. And you can see I have the JavaScript, since this is a JavaScript application, those JavaScript items come up by default. And you can see one of these is search contract. So if you create that search contract, you can see right here is an example. It gives me search.html. Now this generates not only search.html, but also the search.css and the search.js, the JavaScript as well. So you get all of that support. And then here is the nice layout that you saw of the pictures, the title, the prep time and stuff. All that came back in the HTML. Here's, it gives you most of the code there. So, and then most of that JavaScript actually came, I got for free as well. The only things I really had to do to kind of tweak this are, so this stuff came for free. I added this, these filters for the Chinese, Japanese, the various kinds of food. I added that filter myself since that was specific to my application. I had to choose what HTML, where do I actually navigate to based on what I named that in my application right here. So I did do that. I had to choose what to do the regular expressions on. So add that this was title and directions. I didn't have to change anything with any of this filter logic. So all of these things, I could just use the exact same text that came with the template. And got most of this stuff here for free. And then I did have to do this stuff, the suggestions. I added this myself. All right. So that's kind of a quick look how you can use that template also to get a lot of the way there. All right, let's jump back to the code, or I'm sorry, back to the PowerPoint for a sec. All right. So we saw how to use the right contracts. We saw an example of the search contract. There's also a share contract and some very good stuff that you can do there. So the Contoso Cookbook is actually an example of a sharing source. So it can take that data and share it as a source. So if we have time, I will jump back and show you that as well. So that those are just some example of contracts. And then the next thing we can look at is invest in a great tile. So I honestly think that creating a great tile is a very worthwhile thing to do as a developer. Your tile is what shows up on the start menu, and that can essentially be an invitation into your application. It shows you, if you choose to have it live update, then what you can do is have it populate with a like fresh information. So fresh information could be being pushed down from a server using the Windows notification service without your app even needing to run. So things like that mail application where you saw my last 5 emails popping up, that's an invitation that's saying, hey, there's fresh new content here. Open me up. You know, there's cool stuff going on here. So you can also use live tiles for your application and have very kind of exciting, fresh new content coming down if that makes sense for your application. There's also some cool stuff we can do around secondary tiles, which can deep link into certain portions of your application. So take, for example, a weather application. It may show the weather in a lot of different cities, but maybe I don't care about the weather in a lot of different cities. Maybe I care about the weather in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I live. So in that situation, what I could do is perhaps create a deep link in my weather application so that on the tile screen, it doesn't necessarily show, you know, weather everywhere. It takes me straight to weather in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So let me show you an example of how you would do that as well. We will jump back into the code. And I will show you the tiles. So let me go ahead and run this. And we'll look at this tile functionality. So we run our Contoso cookbook, and I'm going to go ahead and select one of these recipes. How about that Asian slaw? That looks really good. So I have this recipe selected, and now you can bring up the application bar. And the keyboard shortcut to do this is Windows Z, or you can swipe up from the bottom of the screen, and you can see I have this application bar. And this also is specific to my particular application, to whatever is running at the time. So I have a number of options here. There's actually some photo and video functionality you can do to show the various media functionality that we have in Windows 8 in Metro style applications. There is support for that in WinRT. And then there's also this pin recipe. This is what I want to show you. And then we'll get into this stuff later too, reminders and home as well. So let me show you this pin recipe. So I'm going to touch pin recipe. So that means I have this recipe here for Asian slaw. Maybe I think, hey, this recipe is really good. I want to remember to make it later. Let me go ahead and pin this to my start menu. So I'm going to touch pin recipe. And you see it creates for me a little icon that shows Asian slaw. It has Asian slaw here at the bottom. It has that little whisk icon here. And I'm going to go ahead and you can either touch or click with the mouse, pin to start. And so now I can go ahead and close my application. I'll go back to Visual Studio, close it. Now I'm going to go to my start menu. So I'm just going to hit the Windows key. I'll use semantic zoom to jump to the end of my list and zoom in right here. And you can see at the very end of my start menu, I actually have a new thing right here, a new tile that's called Asian slaw. And so what I can do is actually click it. So I'm going to touch it. And what that does is launch my cookbook and take me straight to the Asian slaw recipe. All right, this is an example of a secondary tile. I didn't see that list of recipes. I went straight to Asian slaw. So that's a great way to let the users deep link to a certain place in your application. So let's see the code that we would need to actually do that. I will go ahead and jump back to Visual Studio. And the first thing I want to show you is the app bar, since we actually launched that from the app bar. I'm going to go to this default.html for my application. So here's kind of my main stuff. We have a number of references to my Windows JavaScript library, WinJS, which is very handy to use if you are doing HTML development. We have a number of scripts here in Kitoso Cookbook. And then here's my main code of my application. All of the content actually runs here in this content host. And then this is my app bar, this div right here. And I've given it an ID of app bar so that way I can access it programmatically from the JavaScript. And then you do have to decorate it with this data win control of winjs.ui.appbar, and that will create this as an app bar. And then each of those buttons inside of my app bar are actually called commands in Windows 8 nomenclature. And each of these commands are implemented using a button, and this button has to be decorated using this data win control of app bar command. So I will go here to this pin option. So this is the one that we're actually using to pin. Let's look at the things on here. So there's actually a series of data win options we need to set as well. And so we can go through all of these. The first is ID. So I gave it an ID of pin so that I could access it programmatically from the JavaScript. The label is what you will see when we swiped up and got that application bar. You saw that there was actually a little icon as well as some text underneath the icon. The text that shows up underneath the icon is the label. So that's what we have right there. Here is the icon. This is using hex right here to actually grab an icon from a font using the SegUI font. There's actually a number of icons that are embedded into that font. So you can use the character map functionality to actually see a list of all those. But essentially what this gives us right here is a little icon of a pin that we saw in the code. The next thing here is these sections. So you may have noticed that four of those buttons were actually left aligned, and then the last one was actually right aligned. And the reason for that is the way the app bar should be laid out is that commands that are specific to the screen that you're on right now, so they're specific to whatever is selected, should be aligned to the left-hand side. So you would say selection right here and have those be aligned to the left-hand side. There was also one button that was on the right-hand side, and so that is actually a global button that would appear on the app bar no matter what screen I was in inside of my application. So that's considered global, and those should be aligned to the right. All right. So that pin thing was actually specific to just being on the recipe screen. So that would be a selection option right here. And then finally, the last thing we have here is our event handlers. So we have an on-click event, and on the on-click event, we're going to call something called tiles.pinRecipe. So let's look at that code. It's right here in this tiles.javascript. And what I have right here is I am using, again, doing some namespace aliasing like so, and then I'm defining a function in this tiles namespace called pinRecipe. So here's my tiles.pinRecipe. And what I'm doing is grabbing here a resource from my local package, which is in my images file or in my images folder, like so. Up here, I have a logo. So my logo is actually down here. So I do have this logo file that you see, like so. So I'm grabbing that logo, which is that whisk that we saw. And I'm going to create a new secondary tile to do that deep linking. And so I have to pass in a number of arguments. Here's the ID of my tile. I'm going to pass in a short name, because some of these recipe titles get a little bit long. Like there's a, you know, braised, you know, I think there's one that's like one of the German ones is something about a braised bratwurst with small potatoes, German small potatoes, blah, 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 blah. It's a very long recipe. And a title that's that long is not going to fit well onto the start menu tile. So we actually pass in a short title. So that's the title that will appear on that little tile in the start menu. And then we have the full title here as well. Next, we're passing in the key, and this is the activation argument. So that's what we use to know to deep link right to my Asian slaw recipe, as opposed to opening up the cookbook as a whole. And then there's a number of tile options as well. In this case, what we're going to do is show the name on the logo. That's how we saw not only that logo of the whisk, but also the name on it. And then we pass in the logo itself. Okay? And then we're going to asynchronously request that to create that particular tile on the start menu. And there should be some error handling around this as well. All right. I apologize. It is a demo app. All right. So that is a quick look at tiles and utilizing secondary tiles. Let's jump back to the PowerPoint for a quick sec. All right. So we saw how to invest in a great tile as well. The next point of a great Metro application is to feel connected and alive. So you could see with those live tiles that there's all of this information that's being surfaced to me. So you can have things being pushed down using the Windows notification service so that there's fresh content, like you saw with the Mail app and the Facebook updates on my People Hub. So that makes you feel connected and alive. Those tiles, having things like, you can actually have little badges, what we call badges, and that could be a number or a little glyph in the lower right-hand corner of your tile. So for instance, if I have a media player, perhaps in the lower right-hand corner, I show play or paused or something like that, having a little glyph shown right there. Or on my mail application, you saw how there was maybe a little 99 in the lower right-hand corner to show that I had 99 unread messages, that sort of thing. So all kinds of functionality you can have your live tiles updating with to make you feel connected and alive. Another thing that you can do to feel connected and alive is utilize something called toasts. So there are toast notifications that you can use in Windows 8 as well. Now remember with toasts, with great power comes great responsibility, young Spider-Man, all right? So toasts are a great example of something that you want to use when it makes sense and only when it makes sense. Toasts will pop up, and if you are on the desktop or if you are in a different Metro app or whatever, they will pop up and give the user an urgent message from your application. If you do overuse these, then the end user does have the ability to turn them off. So make sure you only use them when the need is truly urgent, because otherwise having pop-ups appear all over the place is not fun. So let's go ahead and jump back to here. Back to my desktop, and I'll show you an example of toasts. All right, so you can see here my Visual Studio, and I'm going to run the application again real quick and show you an example of toasts inside of Contoso Cookbook. We'll go into a different recipe this time. perhaps, let's see, we'll go back here. Let's go, here's the French recipes, German, Indian, Italian, and let's do one of the Mexican recipes. How about that five-layer dip that looks pretty good to me right now? I'll touch that. And so here's an example. We're in five-layer dip or whatever the case may be. I can swipe up, and maybe I want to set a reminder. Maybe I just put my dip in the oven or something, and you want to have a reminder pop up when you need to take it out of the oven, I think is the only contrived cookbook example I can think of at the second. So I have a reminder here, and so I'm going to touch that reminder. And what that's going to do is pop up a reminder for me in 30 seconds. So I'm going to go ahead and close this application out. I'm going to stop it. And I will go to my, I can get some of this code ready for you guys. Let's do the notifications, JS. That's what we're going to look at next. Here's the code. We'll have that all ready. And then maybe I'll go to my start screen. And then in 30 seconds, what should happen is in the upper right-hand corner, aha, like so, we got a reminder. And you can see the Contoso QuickBook application, and I actually hit it twice, so two reminders popped up. So I'm going to touch that reminder, and it will take me back into my Contoso QuickBook. I did not deep link this one. I just had it open the Contoso QuickBook. Okay, so that enabled me to get the reminder and then display it for a few seconds. And then if you touch it, you can actually go back into the application as well. All right. So let me close the cookbook here and go back to the code, like so. Now this is the code that we were actually doing for the Java for the toast. Again, this is called from the app bar, and so that was using that fourth button that I used. So the reminder button, you saw the reminder. There was a little reminder icon. It was context specific, which is why we saw the selection here. And then this is calling notifications.scheduledToast. So I can go to this notifications code, and here's the actual logic that we used. So here's our notification scheduled toast. What we're doing here is creating a toast notifier using this toast notification manager. And so the first thing we need to do is make sure that notifications are enabled. So the end user does have the ability to turn them off. So if they try to set a notification, but they've already disabled their notifications, then we want to send them a little message that says, hey, you've already disabled your notifications. So that's if they're not disabled, this is going to just show a pop-up dialog. We're going to pop that up that says notifications are currently disabled. And the way, as an end user, by the way, the way that you would go ahead and disable that, if I jump to my start menu right here, you can go here into settings. And in the settings, you can see right here, there's this notifications option. So I could touch notifications like this and turn them off. This will turn off notifications so that they won't pop up. Okay, I'm going to turn them back on for now. So I'll jump back to my code. Just wanted to show you that. So that way, if the user has turned off their notifications, they will tell them, hey, they're already turned off, so that they realize that and they can turn them back on. Now, what we're going to do is, if they haven't turned notifications off, we will continue on and get a template of the toast. So you can't put just anything in those toasts. There are certain templates you need to follow, but there are so many templates that do give you a lot of different options. I use the very most boring template that there is, which is the very first text-only one. So this is Toast Text 01. There's an enumeration of them here, toast template types. And I use the first text-only one. But you can use whichever one you want. There are ones that allow you to show pictures as well and lots of other functionality. So you get that template content. So here I'm grabbing kind of that toast template content. I'm grabbing an element from there, which is the text property. So I want to set that text property. And then I'm appending on there a text node, which just has the simple text of reminder, which is what we saw in that pop-up. Then I want to schedule that toast to appear in 30 seconds. So I'm going to grab the current date time, and I'm going to add 30,000 milliseconds to it, which will allow it to appear in 30 seconds. And then I go ahead and schedule it, passing in that template, which is all filled out, as well as the date. Then that will schedule it to appear in 30 seconds. I add it to the scheduler, and I'm set. All right, so fairly straightforward stuff there as well. That was Toast. One last thing I want to say about Toasts. There is something in Visual Studio here, this application manifest, that I want to show you real briefly. And In here, this has a whole bunch of metadata about your application. If you are going to use Toast, you actually have to go here in this notification section and set that yes, your application is Toast capable. There are a number of things here that you do have to declare about your application, and so the fact that I use Toast does have to be declared. Here in this capabilities section, there's also a number of other things that need to be declared. So if you're using the internet, if you're tapping into things like microphone and webcam functionality, you declare all of those up front, and you will get an error if you don't declare them. And you try to use the corresponding functionality in your code. But this will allow this information will be visible to the end user when you push your application up to the Windows Store. So that way, there's this sense of trust, right? If I am downloading an application from the Windows Store, I can see exactly what that application is going to do. If it may try to use my webcam, I'm aware of that up front. So it makes it very nice for the developer because you explicitly say, hey, here's all the stuff that I'm going to do. And then the end user has this very explicit, okay, here's the list of all the things my application can do, and I know that it can't do things outside of that. So there's a lot of trust there, which is nice. All right, so I'm going to jump back to the PowerPoint very briefly. And we can finish up kind of this list of Metro-style applications. We saw the whole kind of feeling connected and alive using Tiles as well as Toasts. You also have the ability to easily roam the cloud. So there's actually a very easy piece of code you can write. When you're writing out your application settings, you can set those settings to be roaming. And so just writing out your application settings as roaming settings will let us on the back end, Microsoft will take that information that you've written out to these roaming settings and sync it to the end user's Microsoft account in the background. And so you can think of that kind of as the evolution of Live ID. You now have this Microsoft account. And so if I have a reading application and I am reading a Harry Potter and I am on page 78, the writer of that reading app could, if it's like a Kindle app or something like that, they could write out the book that I'm reading, Harry Potter, and the page that I'm on, 78. And then what could happen is if I go and open that on a different device, so if I open up that same reading app on a different device, a different machine, it could roam those settings. So that reading app could automatically open up for me the Harry Potter book, open already to page 78. So really, really nice functionality that can give your users this seamless experience across devices. So think about what settings make sense to roam and then utilize that functionality to have them roam easily across the cloud. All right, we're getting short on time, so let's jump. I've been doing kind of various demonstrations of the Contoso QuickBook throughout, so you guys have already seen a bunch of good demos here. And then one final thing that I want to talk about is before we get into the Windows Store is process state transitions. So this is really, really important. You saw that all of our applications run full screen and immersive. So what that means is I can have an application running. I might swipe away to check a different application and then swipe back. So let's say I have my running application here. Let's say I'm playing a game. Let's say I'm playing that Cut the Rope game again. So I have my running application, and maybe I swipe over just to check my email. When I swipe away from the Cut the Rope game, what will happen is that game will get suspended, and there is a suspending event that is fired. And at that point, my Cut the Rope app will then be in a suspended state. Now, what that actually means is that the main program threads are suspended, and all of that, and it is still, the game is still held in memory. So it's still all in memory, but the main threads are suspended. Now, background threads may still be executing, that sort of thing. But your main program thread is suspended. And so I might be playing the game. I might swipe away, check my email, or look at my email. And maybe I don't really have any interesting email right now. There's nothing that's totally urgent. So I go ahead and I swipe back to my running application. In that case, a resuming event would... it would resume, and that now my application would be running again, okay? Everything would still be held in memory, and then those threads would just keep going again, all right? That's the kind of simple case. But now let's say that I was playing Cut the Rope, I swiped away to check my email, And I had a very urgent email from my boss that he really needed those TPS reports right now. So I may need to open up Excel and do some number crunching. I may need to open up PowerPoint and do, you know, get a presentation ready for my boss. I might be opening all these different applications and just completely forget about my game. And maybe, you know, my app, I've been leave my machine running for a couple days and that cut the rope game hasn't been played in a while. And eventually, since all of these things are running full screen and they're all being held in memory, what can happen is that eventually my game, my Windows may say that it needs some more resources. So at that point, what would happen is when we are getting low on resources, Windows on its discretion can figure out using an algorithm what applications make the most sense to close. And at that point, it will terminate things. All right. So the very, very, very important key point to remember on this slide is that there is an event fired between running app and suspended app. There's a suspending event. There is not an event fired between suspended app and terminated app. Okay. So when that low resources condition happens, at that point, you should have already saved off anything that would need to be saved. So my point is, when your app is running and you get this suspended event, what you should do is plan for the very worst case. Plan for the case that your application could be terminated at some point in the future. So when that suspended event fires, you actually have 5 seconds, which is an eternity in computer time. You have 5 seconds to save off any state that you may want. So I might want to save off, like in that reading example, I might want to save off the book that I'm reading and the page number I'm on, something simple like that. And then what happens is when you're actually resuming your application, when your application is starting up again, there's actually a way to tell if your application is starting back up from a terminated state. So if it was in fact terminated, you can essentially rehydrate your application to bring it back to the exact same state that it was at before it was closed. So in that case, your end user might not even be able to tell that your app was closed and reopened. Okay, because you can use that settings to just to figure that out and just rehydrate it and have it all going for them just as it was. All right, that's a quick look at process state. Now, for the last 5 minutes, I want to talk about the Windows Store. I'm really excited about the Windows Store. There's a lot of opportunity here. The Windows Store has absolutely unprecedented reach. So there are over 500 million copies of Windows 7 out there. And these are copies of Windows 7 that we have actually sold, right? So there may be even more running rampant. So absolutely unprecedented reach. That's just Windows 7 that we've sold. So just a huge reach. Windows is available in over 100 different languages in, I think, 231 different markets. There's just a huge, huge market potential. If you have an application that you want to get out there, just a huge amount of reach. The Windows Store has also been optimized for discoverability. So they've done a lot of work around search engine optimization. So if I were to create a new game called Angry Poultry, and I wanted to have that be available. If you type that into a search engine, that should make my very obvious Angry Birds ripoff pop up as one of the first things in the Windows Store. All right, so typing in those app names should be optimized on all of the major search engines, should be able to find them right away and bring up those listing pages for your application in the Windows Store. There's also something else for discoverability that I'll talk to you about in just a second, but there's a way to deep link from Internet Explorer 10 in Windows 8 as well. I'll talk about that in one more second. There's a very transparent approval process. I will show you some examples of that in 1 second. Very flexible business models. So you can have paid applications. You can have free applications. You can have free applications with ad support. For ad support, you can use Microsoft's ad support or you can use a third-party ad support. There's the ability to roll out updates. You can have trials. Trials can be the trials for your paid apps. The trials can be either feature-based trials or time-based trials. There are the ability to have in-app purchases. So I may already have purchased a game where, you know, 100 levels are available to me. And then maybe at the end of the 100 levels, you can make an in-app purchase where for another, you know, another book or something, I can unlock another 50 levels or something like that. So all of these things are available, very, very flexible, very, very, a lot of flexibility in the business model. So a lot of cool stuff there. And then there's also the ability to maximize your developer revenue. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in just a second, too. All right, so I mentioned discoverability. There's one other thing. So this here is the IE10 Metro screen. So there's a Metro version of Internet Explorer 10 that you can utilize in that ships with Windows 8. And so I have an example here of an app. And this app, I am navigated here in Internet Explorer, the Metro version. And you can use a couple of lines of some metas. You can stick some metas in the header of your web page that will allow you to service this little icon right here. So if I am Evernote and I have a very popular website, I can actually put this icon right here that says, hey, I have an application in the Windows Store. And it's essentially a meta tag in your HTML that points to the app listing ID in the Windows Store. And so the experience for the end user is that when they navigate to Evernote.com, and you have that in your website, then they will see this little icon here that says get the app. So I can say, oh, cool, you know, I like Evernote, I use it a lot. Let me go ahead and get the Windows Store, the Windows 8 app for it too. So they can click this button right here, and that will take them to the Windows Store listing page. So you have the ability to do that. Then you can also, if they've already installed it, that it will still be here, and I can just actually click on it if it's already installed, and that will launch the app for me. So really, really neat integration here with the Metro version of Internet Explorer that gives great discoverability. Because, I mean, if I see, I mean, think about your favorite websites. If XKCD, if I navigate to XKCD and they have a get the app here, I'm going to get to the XKCD app because I love that site. So very similar thing. If you have, you know, brand loyalty and customers that are really, you know, really dig your stuff, then really great way to surface that, hey, I have a Windows 8 Metro app as well. All right. I mentioned the great opportunity for developers. So for revenue sharing, any new application that you write will start with 70%. You get 70% of the revenue share, and which is the same thing as our competitors offer. But we actually do something extra as well. After your application makes $25,000 US, your share of the revenue jumps to 80%. So essentially, you are rewarded for writing great applications. So you can get to that 25K however you want. You could write a less expensive application that more people download, or a more expensive one that fewer people download. But however you get to that 25K, once a single app hits that amount, then you will get 80% of the earnings on that particular application. All right? So very, very cool functionality there, I think. So we're rewarded for writing awesome applications. The next thing I want to talk about just very briefly is trials. So we have done some research with the Windows Phone marketplace, and we found that if you write a paid application and you include a trial, a paid application with a trial is 70 times more likely to be downloaded than a paid app without a trial. There's also about a 10% conversion rate, where they actually go ahead and buy that, they convert from a trial all the way to the fully bought paid version. And paid applications with trials tend to make about 10 times more revenue. These are just some really quick numbers. There's actually a post on the Windows Phone Developer blog that goes into this in a lot more detail. Ping me if you want and I'll give you the full link, but it's really interesting information. There is a trial API available for Windows 8 Metro as well. So if you are thinking about writing paid apps, I strongly suggest you implement the trial functionality as well. Your downloads are likely to be much better. There's also something called the Windows Application Certification Kit, which is acronymed WAC. And what this will do is run a series of automated tests on your application locally before you submit it to the store, to the Windows Store. So if you know you want to submit to the Windows Store, this will allow you to run a lot of those automated tests before you even have to submit. So that's great, because instead of waiting that, you know, in that feedback loop of, oh, I've submitted, now I have to get my results, you know, wait for my results back. You can just run a whole bunch of these automated tests locally first, and then know that, you know, all this stuff is already going to pass when you submit to the store. So definitely use the Windows App Certification Kit and make sure that your app passes before you submit to the store. Here's a quick look at your developer dashboard. So in this situation, we have an app that we have submitted to the store, and we can go to our dashboard and see exactly where it is in the certification process. So I think this is really cool, because we have not only, you know, here's where I am, I'm in pre-processing, It not only tells me exactly where I am, so here's this part is in progress, all of these are still pending, and then it will actually change once you get to, you know, these things will all go green as I complete them. But it tells me exactly what the steps are, and it tells me exactly how long they usually take. So I can see, okay, this is going to be done in about an hour, this is going to take about 3 hours, etc. So very, very transparent certification process. And you can go to your developer dashboard at any point and see exactly where you are in the certification process with your application. All right, so as I mentioned, there are over 700 million copies of Windows. And by Windows, I just mean Windows 7, and I just mean Windows 7 licenses that we've actually sold. All right, so that's just Windows 7 that we've sold. There are 234 million Android phones, 13 million Android tablets, 112 million iPhones, 40 million iPads, and 30 million Macs. If you think about the development cost to kind of do those things, you could probably combine Android development efforts into one, and then iPhone and iPad could combine into kind of iOS development. But one thing that I think is kind of just an interesting business fact is if you look at the size of these markets, if you add together all of the Android devices, plus all of the iPhones, plus all of the iPads, plus all of the Macs, that number is still lower than just the number of Windows 7 licenses that we've sold, that we know about. All right? So that's pretty big. There is just an absolutely huge global market for Windows. And so if you do have a really cool app idea, I hope that you suggest you consider putting it in the Windows Store, because there's just a great opportunity there, the greatest opportunity for developers, I think, that we've seen in a long, long time. All right, so if you'd like to go ahead and get started with Windows 8 development, please use this bit.ly link. If you do that, I will get credit for it. I very much appreciate that. My team and I all kind of work in a distributed environment, and so we like to kind of track and measure. Since we're all engineers, I'd like to measure the impact that I'm having. So if you do use this link to download Windows 8, I will get quote unquote credit for it. So I would very much appreciate that. It is a bit.ly, so it is case sensitive. So if you don't mind using that link, if you do download Windows 8, I'd be very grateful. Also, if you are interested in early access to the Windows Store, right now, the Windows Store is open to everyone to download apps. It's in the beta version at this point in time, but it's not open to the public to submit applications, so developers can't go ahead and submit right now. But myself and my team across the world are all working on trying to find great applications to have as the very first applications in the Windows Store. So if you are interested in early access to the store, you have an app or an app idea that you're working on, please contact your local developer evangelist, and we will try to get you guys in there and talk you through, here's the process to make that happen, okay? All right, some final resources. We have the Windows Developer Center, awesome resource, dev.windows.com. The design side of the house is also really important. With these beautiful Metro style applications, you really want to nail the design side of it. So design.windows.com has a bunch of great resources there. We also have the Building Windows blog at blogs.msdn.com /B8. And then my blog is blogs.msdn.com /Jennifer. And I have some good resources coming. All right, I will switch it back over to Eric, and then I am happy to hang out for a while and answer any questions that may have come in through the question window as well. I've not been keeping up on that. So I will go through and answer those right now and take any questions. So let's see. It looks like somebody wants my Twitter information. I will put that in the window. One question is here, do the applications for Vista work on 8? So anything that works on Windows 7 will work on Windows 8. If it was an application that was written for, say, like XP, that's not necessarily guaranteed to run on Windows 7 or Windows 8. So you may need to do some updates on XP. But again, it just depends on the APIs that you've used and things like that. But it's certainly not guaranteed. See. How how do Firefox and other browsers work on 8? So Firefox and Chrome and such, they run on Windows 8 just fine. And then I don't know if you've seen the news, but they've also committed, Google and Firefox have also committed to creating Metro versions of their browsers as well. So there will be Metro Firefox and Chrome browsers as well on Windows 8. Yep, great question. Let's see. IE10, there's a question here. When will IE10 be released? So IE10 will be released with Windows 8. So it will ship at the same time as Windows 8 and be included with Windows 8. Will this webcast be recorded for later viewing? Yes, it is being recorded. I will publish it to my blog once I get a link. I believe they are going to make it available on through the TechEd site. So what we're going to do is I will publish it on my blog. So if you copy down my blog, which is blogs.msdn.com/Jennifer, I will also have a link to, I will put a link to this recording on there whenever it's available. Is remote desktop or remote assistance going to be available? Yes, great question. It is available right now. I've actually used it from Windows 8, so yes, it works just great. It's one of the things that there's actually a live tile for it on my desktop right now. So yes, you will have remote desktop. In Vista, I can change the desktop view to basic or previous Windows versions. Will Windows 8 allow that? So you do have the same desktop as you're used to, but the Windows start screen, that's the main thing that's different in Windows 8. And right now, I do not believe that there is a way to change that back to the old way. You have to use that Metro version of the start menu. Yes, there may be a learning curve. So when you're first getting used to it, change is always, it's change, right? Change can be a little difficult, but I can tell you, I've been using Windows 8 for a while, and it honestly flows now. I mean, I think when you very first start, it seems almost like there's these two disparate experiences, but it honestly now I love it. And when I'm working on my older Windows 7 machines, I find myself wanting to switch, and it doesn't work. And I'm just like, oh. So honestly, it does get easy. I know, when the ribbon came out for Office, remember that? It was really, really difficult at first, just getting used to the change. And now, I wouldn't go back. I love the new ribbon. What other questions do we have here? Are there going to be simulators for Windows 8 and IE10 available soon? So you can download Windows 8 right now using that link that I showed you on the previous screen. I can pop to that. So you do have the ability to run it in a virtual machine. I think there's probably people who have put virtual machine versions out there already. So you could take advantage of that if you'd like. Just run it in a virtual machine if that would help, if you would prefer that. And then, of course, there's great simulation in Visual Studio. If you're a developer, I would strongly recommend using that Visual Studio simulator to, you can simulate, a slate type device if you don't have a slate, and touch if you don't have touch and that sort of thing, and being able to pick up and move things around. Yes, so someone asked, is the tile a new version of a desktop shortcut icon? So you can still have desktop shortcut icons in Windows 8. So there's still a desktop. You still have the same desktop that you've had. It's really only the start menu that's changed. But yes, you do have a tile is essentially kind of like a desktop shortcut icon plus, right? Because not only do you have the ability to, touch it or click it and go into that application, but you also have the ability to have, that live stuff updating and refreshing. You have the ability to, push information down to it so that new information is surfaced, even if the app isn't running. You have the deep linking ability, a lot of cool stuff. So it's even cooler than a desktop shortcut icon. So someone asked about the code. End users definitely don't have to go through the code. I'm sorry. So someone was confused about the as an end user, are we going to have to go through the code to run an app? So no, I was showing you an example for developers, since this was a developer-focused talk. But if you don't, what will happen is when you run an application in Visual Studio, it will automatically create a tile for it on the start screen. So you can go to your start screen, and an end user would just run things through the start menu, and no, they would never see code. Okay. So someone asks about the thread suspension. So someone asks, what if I have something? So I think this was around the process, the application lifecycle functionality. The question was, why have the thread suspend? What if I have something that needs to run in the background, like virus protection? So you do have that capability as well. Your main thread of execution will suspend when you swipe away from something, when it goes into the suspended state. But there are ways to utilize background functionality as well. For example, a music player. In a music player, you may want to have the music. I might want to, you know, switch and be coding or something, but I still want my music playing in the background. So you do have the ability to create background tasks in those Windows 8 APIs. There are absolutely ways to do that. So yes, something like virus protection, yes, you do have the ability to create real background tasks that will run things in the background. Okay, so that is in there. Why doesn't it automatically save when it's being forced to shut down? I think the question there, again, was around process, the application lifecycle. So you as the developer really have to decide what to save, right? There's no way to automatically save because your application is your application. And you know, Microsoft doesn't necessarily know what's important to save in that scenario. So what you can do to create great apps is think about what things need to be saved and what things don't need to be saved, and then store just enough information to be able to rehydrate that scenario should you want to later. Okay. Let's see. All right. I may have missed some questions, so if I have, feel free to reach out to me on Twitter, on email, on my blog, again, which is right here. So if you do have further questions, feel free to reach out to me, and I will answer it as best I can. All right? Thanks very much, guys.